Alrighty, welcome back to the Carol Cox Show, and the second half, and as I said earlier, and I have my guest here is Dr. Robert Geffner, who is a clinical research professor of psychology, and I'll allow him to tell us a bit about himself, and this is going along with the earlier issues we've had on violence and abuse and trauma and family issues and family courts and things of that nature, and I thought we'll reach out, and he's in town now for a conference, and we're going to let him tell us all about that, and we'll get into some of the questions. And if any of you out there have questions for Dr. Geffner, feel free to call. We're not giving legal advice over the airwaves, but you might have some. He can steer or guide you to some correct source or something. So good morning, Dr. Geffner.
Good morning.
All righty. If you could share with us a bit about yourself and how you got started with this, and if you would.
Yes, first let me apologize for any laryngitis. Unfortunately, I picked it up yesterday on the plane over, so hopefully the voice is okay.
Okay.
Yes, I am a psychologist. I'm the president of the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma. We're located in San Diego. We're an international research, direct services, resource, and training center. We're part of Alliant International University. And actually, our institute is the result of the merging of the Family Violence and Sexual Assault Institute that I started about 26 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it merged with Alliant and formed this new institute. We put on conferences all over the country and do training in other countries as well. And we also provide direct services for people in our area. And we train doctorate students in psychology. We train mental health professionals in a variety of areas.
Mm-hmm.
In Hawaii, it's sort of interesting because my wife is local. She was born in Hilo, even though we met on the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been coming over here and back ever since. We've been married many moons ago. And just watching all the good things that were happening here in the field of dealing with violence, abuse, and trauma.
Mm-hmm.
And about 15 years ago, started doing some consulting and then linked up with Kapi'olani, a child protection center. And Steve Choi, who directs that, who's also a psychologist, he and I started doing some training here. We figured instead of people going to the mainland, why don't we try to offer some training here on the different islands? And that's sort of how the conference here got started. And then 10 years ago, after doing some training, we said, you know, people come to Hawaii to put on conferences, but it's not for the local people. It's for people to come here, and they charge too much, and the local mm-hmm. people don't benefit. So we said, why don't we try to put on a conference, you know, for Hawaii, by Hawaii, and bring some mainland speakers over and interact with the local ones. And that sort of evolved into the trauma conference that we have here now. We're going into our eighth year. It's called Preventing, Assessing, and Treating Child, Adolescent, and Adult Trauma. And it has grown each year. It is now the largest conference that's interdisciplinary in the islands that's really set up for the people here. And we have local planning committees. We have local sponsors. A lot of your nonprofits and state agencies are involved. And it takes us a year to put this event on. We probably this year have near 100 speakers, most from the islands, but we have speakers from Alaska, from different parts of the United States, and people from all over the islands come, but we also get people now, because of the quality of this conference, coming from other countries. I just saw that we have somebody coming from the Philippines, somebody coming from Taiwan, somebody from Germany, so we usually draw about six or seven other countries. So it's really grown, and we have, as I said, the Hawaii Children's Trust Fund, Kapi'olani, the Children's Justice Center, Family Programs Hawaii, A&B Foundation, and now the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, all helping, Consuelo Foundation, and that's what really makes it work. And so it goes for about 3 days. It'll start Tuesday at the Ala Moana Hotel, and we have the largest turnout that we've ever had already. We have near 700 people coming in one of or more of those 3 day periods. And we have some training that starts tomorrow special too.
Now, is there a cost associated with this? And how would one reach, get in touch to get attend this that have not signed up?
Well, now they'd have to do it on site. There is a website. I mean, people usually can go to our website. In fact, if they want to see the program, they could still go to the website to see, which is www.ivcenters.org. But now you'd have to come on site like Tuesday or Wednesday and just register. There are indeed slots available. If somebody is not a student or not a volunteer, it's probably around $250 for the whole event. But we did have, thanks to many of those sponsoring organizations, we had quite a few sponsorships and scholarships. So we have people from neighbor islands. We have people who have a native Hawaiian background. We have different areas that we were able to provide scholarships this year, which really was helpful.
Now, how did you end up organizing this conference? Why? I heard you mention the word trauma. If you would, was that one of the catalysts for this, or what?
Well, originally, the main thing that started with Steve and I years ago was focusing on children, because we know children are the key to the future. And if you have a child who's been traumatized either through exposure to some type of violence or abuse or directly abused, then that can have long-term effects, last throughout their lifetime. So there's so many different programs here in the islands, and you have such a diversity that we thought, you know, it'd be good to really start focusing on that. What do we know? What don't we know? And how can we improve the way things are? And so that's what started it. And the first time we put this on, we ended up with 100 people. And we said, hey, that's not bad. So there must be a need. And so it's just evolved. And where we started with maybe a couple of tracks focusing on children and teens, we've now expanded out quite a bit over the years in much broader based conference now.
So the incidences of violence and trauma, they were, we have enough to cause concern for here in Hawaii to cause concern.
Definitely. Yes. I mean, unfortunately, Hawaii in that respect is no different from any of the other states. They're way too much trauma in lives of all of us. And unfortunately, most of that is human-made. In other words, you can be traumatized from an accident, You could be traumatized from a natural disaster, but you can also be traumatized by being beaten, being abused, being put down on a daily basis, by being bullied, by being exposed to these things. In other words, if you grow up in a home where there's domestic violence, that causes severe trauma. If you grow up in a community where there's a lot of gang violence, that too. Mm-hmm. If you grow up in a home or a community where there's substance abuse, these are things that we address because these are the key issues in children's lives. And if they don't address them early, if we don't develop programs to prevent the trauma and the abuse, then they have long-lasting effects. We know that kids, for example, who are indeed traumatized at early ages and growing up in these types of homes or communities, mm-hmm. are much greater risk for substance abuse. You know, and you definitely have a substance abuse issue here on the islands, just like we have it elsewhere. But in some cases, much worse. Methamphetamines are much worse in Hawaii than in some of the other states. Mm-hmm. And they're much greater risk if they have that kind of trauma. We also know that virtually every type of physical illness, mental illness, has some kind of roots in adverse childhood experiences. That's the official term used in the field, adverse childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. And that ends up making things much worse. Mm-hmm. They are much more likely to be exploited when they get older if they've never been treated. Mm-hmm. They're much more likely to act out if they tend to do that. We know that our prison systems are composed by a large percentage of people who have these types of traumatic experiences and then ended up not really adjusting in a healthy way.
Mm-hmm. So a couple things I read in your brochures and all, you talked about an intimate partner. And what's that entail? What does that entail when we speak about intimate partner, trauma, violence, and what have you?
That's the official word. Most often it's referred to as domestic violence. When one person in the relationship is physically or sexually or psychologically or verbally abusing the other in order to gain power and control over them, to intimidate them. That's what produces the trauma. It produces the trauma in the victims, and it produces the trauma in the children who are in those homes. Mm-hmm. Even if they're not in the room when it happens, if they hear it, if they see the after effects, all those things still produce significant trauma. And that trauma can affect their brain development, affect their emotional development, their social development. So by domestic violence, that's what we're referring to. When one adult is, through one of these techniques of power and control, acting that way toward the other. And Hawaii is no different from other states in the incidence rates. Mm-hmm. It occurs much too often, even now.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask a more specific question. Here we have some really heinous, some violent acts against women. What could you offer some of the signals, and what would you advise a woman when she experienced this? She find herself alone with this person after she've initiated complaints or what have you?
Well, and as you pointed out, most domestic violence, a woman is indeed the victim, but we actually do deal with men who are victims as well. But most often it is a male perpetrator and a female victim. Mm-hmm. Signs, and this is another thing that we know also, is domestic violence doesn't usually just crop out of nowhere. In other words, it's not all of a sudden where the person starts beating up the other person. If that happened, virtually everybody would just leave right away. It's a gradual process. Sometimes it could happen and does happen in dating or in teens. Mm-hmm. Much more subtle at the beginning. So red flags would be somebody who seems to have to be in control all the time. Mm-hmm. They seem to be very jealous, very possessive. Things have to be their way. And they tend to put you down verbally. Maybe not really overtly or strongly at the beginning, but sort of gradual. And then over time, this often escalates. You know, so the forms of power and control get more and more severe, and then you may indeed have a physical incident. And now what causes victims lots of trauma and difficulty is because the perpetrator then is very remorseful most of the time. You know, apologizes, says they'll never do it again, and the person wants to believe it. I mean, there usually is a love relationship there, but it gets mixed up with all the control issues and power issues. So the possessiveness sometimes is viewed as cute at the beginning, but then it starts getting stifling. So if somebody feels like they're in that type of situation where the other person has to be in control, then that could be a problem.
Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the red flags for people if they all of a sudden start realizing that this relationship isn't going the way they need to and want to, and it's a loss of freedom, mm-hmm. feelings of helplessness, feelings of, you know, I'm not worth much. Mm-hmm. And those are the types of threats we see where somebody would say, you know, without me, you're nothing.
Mm-hmm. And can you speak to, while we're on this, and we'll get back to other more formal questions, but I've noticed, I've spoken with friends or have become familiar with certain cases where they're told, I just endured because it's going to destroy my family, or I won't be able to meet the bills, I can't send my kids. Should that be a reason to stay in that relationship?
Well, it's hard to say what should and shouldn't be reasons. People do stay for a variety of reasons. Obviously, that's one. It is interesting that many victims of domestic violence do feel that if they stay, they need to because of their children, that they don't want to break up the family. Or they also feel, which is interesting, that they've hidden it from the kids. Both the perpetrators and the victims often have this illusion that the kids don't know.
Mm-hmm.
When we do research and we ask adults, like, do the kids know? Something like 60-70% say no, you know, they weren't there, or, you know, we kept it from them. But then you interview the kids and you ask them, you know, what goes on in their family. Mm-hmm. 80% of them can tell you exactly and have been affected by it. And so one of the things we try to do in the programs and the conference and others is to see which programs seem to be most successful. And how do we educate? How do we educate ourselves? How do we educate the public as to what the signs are? And what are some of the ways to deal with it? You know, are there ways that both victims and perpetrators and children can get help? And the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm.
If people go in, there are some very good programs throughout the islands, and part of the conference is to train more people on how to actually set up prevention and treatment for all family members.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things that's most interesting, because the Ohana spirit, the family, is so important in the islands. And there are many good programs that help families combat these issues. But you have to start, and you have to be able to recognize. And that's why the conference is important. We help train people in all professions on how to identify, how to help people, whether they come into an emergency room or into their pediatrician or in the schools.
Mm-hmm.
How do we identify kids and teens who have been traumatized so we can help,
mm-hmm.
help prevent the long-term effects? And that's part of the goal.
With these new budgetary constraints that we see now at our doorstep, do you believe that that is having a negative impact, or should more money be put into this, or will we see an increase of violence and trauma in this time of this era?
Well, we're already seeing a gradual increase now, that's partly due to the economy. When you stress out family members, stress them out in a variety of ways, then people react to the stress. And that reaction can produce situations that make things worse. So if there was some type of tendency toward domestic violence, it makes it worse. It doesn't all of a sudden create it. There are people who are having significant financial difficulty, but doesn't mean they hit their spouse or their kids. But if those tendencies were there, it then increases the likelihood. So now with the economy, with unemployment, with the military situation, and people, quite a few people in the military and their families who are deployed or exposed to trauma in war zones and then coming back, all those things end up increasing the risk in families. So you raise a really important point, which is if we know that with all these things going on around us, that's increasing the likelihood of child abuse or spouse abuse or these other types of things, then how do we deal with it budgetarily? And that's where we've definitely had a problem, because if you look through the state here, the state I'm in, other states, and federally, the budget cuts usually are in the social programs, the mental health programs, because too many times people have short-term goals and they're only looking at the short term. But we know, like for every dollar we spend in prevention, in working with these families at the beginning, working with the kids, with the adults, you save, you know, $100 down the road in mental health costs, medical costs, criminal justice costs, legal costs. But we tend not to think that way. So that's been the challenge here in the islands. Many good programs have seen severe cutbacks, like 30% layoffs. And that's going to make it much more difficult. And that's something we're trying to deal with at the conference this week. How do we compensate? How do we deal with that? And that's now with you have a new administration, and that's some of the things they're trying to deal with is they seem to be in tune, obviously, with these issues. There's some very good people who are involved in our conference who are now in the administration. And so the challenge is, what do we do with limited funds? And if I had the easy answer, boy, I would give it, but there is no easy answer.
You're listening to the Carol Cox Show. My guest here is Dr. Robert Geffner, and he's a clinical research professor, and we're talking about violence, abuse, family abuse, all of those issues. He has a conference coming up, taking place here in the next week at the Ala Moana Hotel.
Yes.
And do you have a local phone number that someone, or they can just come to the facility, and what time again?
Best thing, first, is to look at that website just to see what the program is. And we, by the way, do have, we have consumers, we have all different types of people who come to the conference for different reasons. The website is www.ivat, Institute Violence Abuse Trauma, IVAT, Centers, CENTERS.org. And that's where they can get the information. If they want to actually register, then the best shot is to go to the Ala Moana Hotel. We take over the second floor starting Tuesday morning or Wednesday morning. I mean, you can come to any one day, as you can see on the website. You don't have to go to all 3 days. And we have some people who do that. But they could pick out, you know, what they think would be most useful, or tell their colleagues and friends. As I said, we are really excited because of the large attendance this year. Given the economic struggles here in the islands, we are quite surprised at the turnout. But virtually all the nonprofit agencies, many of the state agencies, are involved this year, and I think that's what really helped, because this is so cost effective. Instead of sending the people to the mainland or elsewhere to be trained, they could do it right here. And that's what's been, I think, most gratifying, is to see the benefit of these programs and the networking, people here meeting each other and learning who the referral sources are and how do we work together, because that's the only way we're going to really have a shot at changing the way things are is by working together.
Mm-hmm. 524-1080 is the number if you have a question or a comment for Dr. Geffner. Help yourself in calling, and we'll hope to, if we can offer a little bit of insight. Now, in the past weeks, I've had victims to call up and share their stories on domestic violence, and where the children were given, the courts gave the children to the abuser, as they describe it. Can you have any insight, and how does one weather that if this a woman or a man find themselves in that predicament? How do they deal with it?
That's a very difficult situation. As you mentioned, I'm also a psychologist, and we do have treatment programs, and I've served on a variety of national committees. And Hawaii is, in this respect, not different than what we're dealing with nationally. Part of our institute is we actually do this type of forensic work. We do evaluations for courts. We actually look through records, and we deal with many of these cases. And it is a sad situation because we do see way too often where victims of domestic violence are indeed losing some or all of the custody of their children to the person who's either been convicted or admitted that they committed some type of domestic violence. And that's been frustrating, not only for them, but also for us in the field, because like so many states, we finally have gotten laws changed that say if there was domestic violence, then the person who commits the domestic violence shouldn't have sole custody or shared custody of the children, because it continues the power and control until they get treatment for mm-hmm. those issues. But unfortunately, people don't want to believe that child abuse or domestic violence occurs, and occurs at the levels that we're seeing. And so it's easier to say the person is making it up and to ignore the evidence. And part of what we've been doing nationally and here in the islands is trying to train judges, attorneys, mental health professionals on how do you actually recognize, how do you identify domestic violence? Mm-hmm. How do you look and assess the trauma that this has had on children so that people can make the appropriate recommendations that would really be in the best interests of the child? It is not in the best interests of any child to essentially put them in the custody of the person who has been abusive. What it does is it teaches this child, even indirectly, that the way you get your needs met is through power and control. Taking out your frustrations on other people, either physically or verbally, but controlling and using power works. Mm-hmm. That's the message when they see no consequences to the adult who's been doing that. When they're growing up in this home and they see this occur, and oftentimes they tell people they, you know, don't want to be living in that environment, and yet it's ignored, and that's where they're placed. We have dealt with some of these kids who have grown up in those homes and now have aged out. In other words, they're over 18. And they're talking about how abusive the environments were, how severely traumatic. And many of them now we're trying to get into therapy programs in order to help them recover and heal from that type of trauma, because their fear is that they'll end up being abused, or they'll end up being abusive, because that's all they've learned. And that is a risk factor that we always worry about.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you, if it's inappropriate, symptoms such as this, how would a spouse or the other half of a relationship deal with this when an individual checks their email or check their telephone history, or have a separate or a secret bank account when they're both sharing it? Is that something one should be concerned with? Is that abuse? And I know that's a specific question.
Well, we have to look at the context. We have to look at what's going on. If this is a pattern of behavior, mm-hmm. in other words, where one person in the relationship controls the resources, hides resources, continually monitors everything the other person is doing, controls who they can see, isolates them from friends and family, then you're getting into an abusive situation, definitely, and a potentially dangerous one, because that person gets isolated. They end up with no support network. They're not able to talk to their own family and friends. And so that's where you see some very abusive things, traumatizing things happen. Mm-hmm. If you're talking about isolated incidents, then that means you have to really deal with communication. But we don't see too many healthy, well-functioning families where one person is checking somebody else's emails, where one person is hiding assets or has secret bank accounts. That's not a sign for a normal, healthy relationship. And it could be a sign that there is more going on.
Mm-hmm. I see. So, in the new law here in Hawaii, and if you can speak to this, civil unions. What is to be expected for couples now? Can they get counseling? Will your program provide couples counseling?
Yes, we do that locally in our area, and there are programs here on the islands, and some of them will be involved this week at the conference, and we'll also be talking about that. There's been a controversy for, well over 25 years now, that if there's any type of abuse in a relationship, that automatically means you can never do any type of couples work or family work. Mm-hmm. And I and many others now have found that that's a good general rule, but not the only rule. If the couples do want to stay together and you're not in a lethal situation where one is actually in fear for their life, and the person feels they can indeed talk in front of the others and express themselves. And we do a risk assessment to make sure that they're not in a risky situation. Then sometimes you can indeed work with the couples, but you have to make sure that this work really focuses on the domestic violence, that the offender has to take responsibility. You're not going to improve or help the situation until the offender accepts responsibility for the abuse and there's no victim blaming. And it's good for the victim to see that, A, you can recover and be a survivor. This isn't the normal way of relationships. Mm-hmm. And that the person is not going to be allowed to continue that type of power and control. So it is a transition for the family members, but it can occur if the people are well trained and in dealing with certain couples. Mm-hmm. So, and there are, as I said, there are programs over here that are looking more at having that alternative. It's mm-hmm. not the method of choice all the time. You have to really look. But what we've learned is the more alternatives you have available, because people are not the same.
Right.
And whether we're talking about an offender, a victim, a survivor, or a child growing up in these homes, one size does not fit all. And so the purpose of our conference and working with all the different programs here is to have alternatives available to meet the needs of each family member in the best way possible. Mm-hmm. So, like this week, we have somebody coming over, a couple people coming over from the mainland to do some training on how do you work with kids who have been trauma. And this type of what's called trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is designed specifically for kids who have been traumatized. We have other programs that are going to focus on how do you work with teens mm-hmm. and in foster care systems when you've had abuse and help them recover. We have presentations on dealing with victims and offenders. So it's across the board. One of the themes this year that I really like, and Hawaii is moving more and more in this direction, is what's called trauma-informed care. Where you are trying to convert your systems, mental health, criminal justice, health care, social service, to be trained in trauma and to be aware of this effect on all the people they come in contact with so they can learn the best programs. And we have a warden coming, Warden Patterson, to talk about how they're looking at this in the prison system because many of the people in there have a trauma history. So instead of just locking them up, throwing away the key, how do we help them recover and, mm-hmm. and become productive citizens? Mm-hmm. So that's a key issue. So
it appears that you're suggesting one, and in your program, is incorporate prevention.
Yes.
So I'm hearing that more than wait until it happens. You're speaking a lot, suggesting that it's prevention.
Well, it's both. I mean, mm-hmm. you don't forget the people who have already been traumatized, right. So that's why the conference is prevention and intervention, mm-hmm. Because people have already been traumatized. So you do have to work with them. You want to help them. We have a panel on Thursday morning of people who have survived different types of trauma and abuse, and it's going to be a plenary panel, so they'll be able to talk a little bit about what helped them recover. That's one of another theme is recovery and healing. What was it that helped them recover and change their lives, and how can that be used by other people? So you have both, recovery, mm-hmm. but you have prevention. Mm-hmm. We know now if we do have programs that can be successful. I mean, one of our co-hosts, in addition to Kapilani and some of the different organizations like Child and Adolescent Mental Health Division and the Family Court System and Prevent Child Abuse Hawaii, all of the different organizations are working together because we do know some ways to prevent, and if we can prevent it, then we don't have to deal with it later.
Right.
And in this budget that's so tight, if we can figure out ways to save money, which prevention does down the road, we need to shift our mentality. And that's what we're trying to do nationally now. Mm-hmm. We're working with organizations nationally as well as locally here and elsewhere to start figuring out how do we make this a national priority, because we don't have that now. Mm-hmm. We have movements for recycling. You know, we have various health issue movements, but we don't have a national priority to eliminate child abuse, mm-hmm. to eliminate spouse abuse, to eliminate sexual assault, elder abuse, which we're going to deal with this year too. And those types of events affect more people than all the other things combined, and yet we don't have that type of national priority. So that's what we're doing here in Hawaii, but also trying to focus on that nationally.
Mm-hmm. Digressing a bit, sure. On the question we talked about, the abuser and the court's giving possession or oversight of the child in a dispute. If the child goes with the abuser,
yes,
does he or she become a victim or become a violator of others?
Well, it's not a one-to-one situation. It means it doesn't have to be that way. And not everybody who's been victimized becomes a victimizer or another victim. But it does increase the odds quite a bit. And so that's why it's important to have intervention or prevention. And the reason is the vulnerability. We know that when people are traumatized and victimized, they become vulnerable. They lose self-esteem. They don't have a good feeling about themselves. They can increase anxiety, stress, depression. These things lead to a person feeling worthless, helpless. They don't always see hope, you know, light at the end of the tunnel. That makes them vulnerable. And we do know that victimizers, in a variety of ways, exploit vulnerability. When you interview rapists, you know, we have all these myths. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody was attractive, or they wore certain clothes, or they were at a certain spot. None of those hold up. What holds up is that sex offenders look for vulnerability, whether we're talking about a child, a teen, or an adult. And so they get exploited. When you're in the situation you described, you increase that vulnerability. That's what makes them at greater risk. And that's what we're trying to counteract.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, if we can change the way we are dealing with these situations in family court that you mentioned, that would go a long way. And that's one of the things we're focusing on this week and in general. We're trying to train mental health professionals on how do you actually do the right kinds of evaluations, because too often people in my field are making these bad recommendations. I mean, they're ignoring the domestic violence or the child abuse. They're ignoring and not trained in dealing with trauma or even assessing it. And they come out with recommendations that are really not appropriate. And then if you have courts that are not trained specifically in this area, then they tend to go along with it. Mm-hmm. So one of our goals here is to make sure that all those people doing child custody evaluations are well trained in the dynamics of domestic violence, the dynamics of child abuse, the dynamics of trauma. And we have workshops starting on Tuesday to do that. We want to make sure that the attorneys and judges are well trained. And so it's a major task, because too often that doesn't occur. And they have this notion that it's, you know, not a big deal. Right now, if a child is not physically hit, or to use your example, a woman is not physically hit, then we tend to discount the other types of domestic violence, the psychological abuse, the verbal abuse, the exposure. Those all have significant long-term effects. But if we don't see broken bones or cuts and bruises and physical damage, then we tend to minimize the effects, the psychological scars. And when you talk to survivors, you know, children who have grown up, for example, what has had the most impact on them is not necessarily the physical injuries. It was the psychological damage that occurred at the same time. And that's what's not viewed as much as it needs to be in these situations that you've mentioned, in the child custody arena, in the family courts, and some of the others. And that's one of the things we're trying to change.
I had an interest. I mentioned to someone that I was having you on as guest, and they were quite interested, and they shared with me. They found themselves, it was a lady, she had married into the local family, and there was abuse, both physical and on. And she wanted to speak out, but the matriarchs stated, don't bring shame to the family. We'll work this out. How does one, or what would you give advice or insight as to what? How would one deal with that?
That's not an easy question either. Quit asking me so many difficult questions. That culture does play a major role, again, especially in the islands, because you have such diverse cultures here. We know already that whatever culture you're in, domestic violence or child abuse, you know, reporting that has a tremendous stigma. There's a lot of pressure. You know, it's what we call the family secret. You know, you don't talk to anybody else about what we do in our home type of situation. Mm-hmm. And that's very strong. It's strong in most cultures. But then you have the pressure, as you mentioned, to not talk about it at all. And so it gets covered up. What that tends to do to many victims, children or adults, is it gives the impression that they did something wrong, that it's not the offender who's responsible. You know, you're somehow to blame. You did something that caused that. And so we're not going to talk about it. And we're just going to, you know, hope it goes away. What we know from the research is that sometimes it does go away. And all the victims we deal with always hope it does. And that's what keeps many of them in the relationship, hoping that it's going to change. But most of the time it does not, unless there's some type of intervention. We also know that when we talk about survivors and victims, recovery does take effort. Not talking to anybody really reduces the likelihood of recovery. Again, not everybody, but most people do need to do that. And that pressure is difficult to overcome. The only thing we could say is that we want to train more people from more cultures to be aware that this is not a helpful recommendation, that people do need to talk to others and find a support system. One of the things that is also current was the way many of the different religious organizations dealt with this. I mean, for years, one of the things we had to deal with was training people in the different faith groups, that telling a victim, just go home and don't do it anymore, or or telling the perpetrator, you know, that's not right, don't do it, doesn't really work real well. And so, fortunately, many more people from different faith communities have been trained and now have programs so that it's not just ignored. And now you see more people coming forward, like with the clergy and child abuse cases, where for years and years that was covered up. And now people are starting to heal and starting to come forward. The only advice I could give is to really try to find somebody you can talk to who will be supportive. And hopefully there'll be somebody else in that environment for that person. And we have to retrain and work with, like you said, the elders and others to know this is not helpful, that this is going to make it worse for the victims and for the children in the homes.
So drug abuse and alcohol, substance abuse contribute to what degree, would you say?
Well, we know it doesn't cause it. There are people who use substances and drink who are not abusive. And there are people who are abusive who don't use substances and they don't drink excessively. But it is a factor, because we know that in many of the situations where there is indeed some type of abuse, some type of violence, there is substance abuse. People do drink excessively. So there's a high relationship. And oftentimes you end up having to deal with both. Because what alcohol and other substances do is they lower inhibitions. So if I already have an anger issue, if I already tend to have attitudes of power and control, and I tend to really try to intimidate, then using alcohol or other drugs will reduce my inhibitions, and so I'll then revert to those behaviors. And so it is an issue. We also know that many victims themselves and children growing up use alcohol or other drugs to hide the trauma, to mask the pain. And so you see them starting at much earlier ages. So that means our treatment programs and our prevention programs have to deal with substance abuse as well.
So it's not necessarily the kid just goes out and hang with a bad crowd. It could be that he is forced or pushed in dealing with that bad environment.
It's a combination. And that's been one of the issues that's been tough, is that people keep wanting simple answers.
Right.
You know, all we do is say no. all we do is say, deal with the substance abuse issues, and then everything will be fine.
Right.
But these are very complex issues when you're talking about violence, abuse, and trauma. So it's a combination of all these. And there isn't an easy answer, which is why people don't want to deal with it. They don't want to have complex solutions. And it is. I mean, if it was simple, like you said, then all these programs that people try, you know, say no to drugs, say no to this, say, that's it. Well, obviously that hasn't worked very well.
So they ignore the science of cause and effect.
That's right. And that, you know, human beings are complex organisms. And our brains and the way we think and the way we act is not a simple thing. And that means our solutions are going to tend to be more complex as well.
Yeah, well, this is the 8th annual Institute of Violence and Abuse Trauma Conference, and it's going to be held at the Ala Moana from Tuesday, May 8th. I'm sorry,
yes.
March. March, gee whiz. This month, this week, March 8th to March 10th, from a Tuesday to a Thursday. The sign-up registration starts at 7:30 a.m.
Tuesday morning, and at the Ala Moana Hotel. And, yes, I mean, we're really pleased that Kapi'olani is co-hosting, and they have the whole time, and that the Child and Family Adolescent Division, we have lots of co-hosts and collaborators this year. Very pleased that we're able to be here, that we're able to participate in helping, you know, people improve their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, good. So, again, there's tracks. You had, what, eight tracks of, if you would, run them down again, sharing what people can look forward to participating.
There are programs dealing specifically with child trauma and child abuse. Specifically with teens dealing in foster care system and youth violence, bullying. There are programs dealing with adults and families, like we've talked about, the different ways that the systems can be trauma-informed. We also have a track on intimate partner violence, you know, how do we deal with victims and offenders. We have a track specifically on helping the military and their families, dealing with the trauma they're experiencing from either being in combat or, you know, deployment issues, those things. So those are some. And then we have a prevention track, you know, that focuses specifically on early intervention and how do we try to, you know, eliminate these problems before they begin. And then the two others that we've added over the years because of the need was one on health care. How do we help health care professionals respond to these, to identify so they know how to refer and what to do? And then criminal justice. So the child custody issues you were talking about, for example, and the other types of things that show up in the criminal justice system with trauma and substance abuse. So those are the different areas that we try to focus on this week.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you for joining me. And you also have published a co-editor of a few papers and whatever, journals. Can you, real quickly, and please, real quick, give you a website again for contact so they can...
Yes, we've published a variety of books on helping children exposed to domestic violence, on dealing with sex offenders, on dealing with treatment programs for domestic violence victims and offenders. So we deal with all these areas that we've talked about. Best way is, again, our website, www.ivatcenters.org. That gets you to our website and all the programs that we have and the conferences and trainings that we put on as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Geffner, I want to thank you for joining me, and feel free to give me a call, and if you're back in town, and update us, or call from San Diego if you got something you want to share with, because it is a problem.
Definitely, and glad to be here. Apologize for loss of voice.
That's okay. The knowledge was just as no problem.
Pleasure to be here, and thank you for the work you're doing.
All righty. Well, thank you. Again, this is the Carol Cox Show, and you can pick us up at carol@carolcox.com, and thanks for joining me. I'll see you next week, and aloha.
Tears running all down my cheek. Yes, I was standing at my window. Tears running all down my cheek. I could see the woman that I love stopping every man in the street she meets. I cried, Lord, have mercy. What wrong in this world have I done? I cried, Lord, have mercy. What wrong in this world have I done? You know, look like every woman I get, she have to get some other one. Yes, a blind man seen her, and a dumb man called her name.
All righty. Welcome back. And real quickly, we got Calvin Griffin coming on next. Go ahead, Calvin. Give us a little...
Okay. Well, thanks for giving me a chance to, you know, real briefly on the program anyhow. Yeah, but I'm back. And, yeah, right after Carol, like I say, we'll be doing our program, Hawaii Bulletin Board radio program, and I hope you'll stay tuned for it.
All right. Welcome back.